this onslaught of last-minute allegations does not ring true. I'm not questioning that Dr. Ford may have been sexually assaulted by some person in some place at some time. But I have never done this to her or to anyone. That's not who I am. It is not who I was. I am innocent of this charge. I intend no ill will to Dr. Ford and her family. The other night, Ashley and my daughter Liza said their prayers, and little Liza, all of 10 years old, said to Ashley, "We should pray for the woman." It's a lot of wisdom from a 10-year-old. We mean no ill will. First, let's start with my career. For the last 26 years, since 1992, I've served in many high-profile and sensitive government positions for which the FBI has investigated my background 6 separate times. 6 separate FBI background investigations over 26 years, all of them after the event alleged here. I have been in the public arena and under extreme public scrutiny for decades. In 1992, I worked for the Office of Solicitor General in the Department of Justice. In 1993, I clerked on the Supreme Court for Justice Anthony Kennedy. I spent 4 years in the Independent Counsel's Office during the 1990s. That office was the subject of enormous scrutiny from the media and the public. During 1998, the year of the impeachment of President Clinton, our office generally, and I personally, were in the middle of an intense national media and political spotlight. I and other leading members of Ken Starr's office were opposition researched from head to toe, from birth through the present day. Recall all the people who were exposed that year of 1998 as having engaged in some sexual wrongdoing or indiscretions in their past. One person on the left even paid $1 million for people to report evidence of sexual wrongdoing, and it worked. He exposed some prominent people. Nothing about me. From 2001 to 2006, I worked for President George W. Bush in the White House. As staff secretary, I was by President Bush's side for 3 years and was entrusted with the nation's most sensitive secrets. I traveled on Air Force One all over the country and the world with President Bush. I went everywhere with him, from Texas to Pakistan, from Alaska to Australia, from Buckingham Palace to the Vatican. 3 years in the West Wing, 5.5 years in the White House. I was then nominated to be a judge on the D.C. Circuit. I was thoroughly vetted by the White House, the FBI, the American Bar Association, and this committee. I sat before this committee for 2 thorough confirmation hearings in 2004 and 2006. For the past 12 years leading up to my nomination for this job, I've served in a very public arena as a federal judge on what is often referred to as the second most important court in the country. I've handled some of the most significant and sensitive cases affecting the lives and liberties of the American people. I have been a good judge. And for this nomination, another FBI background investigation, another American Bar Association investigation, 31 hours of hearings, 65 senator meetings, 1,200 written questions, more than all previous Supreme Court nominees combined. Throughout that entire time, throughout my 53 years and 7 months on this earth until last week, no one ever accused me of any kind of sexual misconduct. No one ever. A lifetime, a lifetime of public service and a lifetime of high-profile public service at the highest levels of American government, and never a hint of anything of this kind. And that's because nothing of this kind ever happened. Second, let's turn to specifics. I categorically and unequivocally deny the allegation against me by Dr. Ford. I never had any sexual or physical encounter of any kind with Dr. Ford. I never attended a gathering like the one Dr. Ford describes in her allegation. I've never sexually assaulted Dr. Ford or anyone. Again, I am not questioning that Dr. Ford may have been sexually assaulted by some person in some place at some time. But I've never done that to her or to anyone. Dr. Ford's allegation stems from a party that she alleges occurred during the summer of 1982, 36 years ago. I was 17 years old between my junior and senior years of high school at Georgetown Prep, a rigorous all-boys Catholic Jesuit high school in Rockville, Maryland. When my friends and I spent time together at parties on weekends, it was usually with friends from nearby Catholic all-girls high schools, Stone Ridge, Holy Child, Visitation, Immaculata, Holy Cross. Dr. Ford did not attend one of those schools. She attended an independent private school named Holton Arms, and she was a year behind me. She and I did not travel in the same social circles. It is possible that we met at some point at some events, although I do not recall that. To repeat, all of the people identified by Dr. Ford as being present at the party have said they do not remember any such party ever happening. Importantly, her friend, Ms. Kaiser, has not only denied knowledge of the party, Ms. Kaiser said under penalty of felony, she does not know me. Does not recall ever being at a party with me ever. And my two male friends who were allegedly there, who knew me well, have told this committee under penalty of felony that they do not recall any such party and that I never did or would do anything like this. Dr. Ford's allegation is not merely uncorroborated. It is refuted by the very people she says were there, including by a longtime friend of hers, refuted. Third, Dr. Ford has said that this event occurred at a house near Columbia Country Club, which is at the corner of Connecticut Avenue and East-West Highway in Chevy Chase, Maryland. In her letter to Senator Feinstein, she said that there were four other people at the house. But none of those people, nor I, lived near Columbia Country Club. As of the summer of 1982, Dr. Ford was 15 and could not drive yet, and she did not live near Columbia Country Club. She says confidently that she had one beer at the party, but she does not say how she got to the house in question, or how she got home, or whose house it was. Fourth, I've submitted to this committee detailed calendars recording my activities in the summer of 1982. Why did I keep calendars? My dad started keeping detailed calendars of his life in 1978. He did so as both a calendar and a diary. He's a very organized guy, to put it mildly. Christmas time, we sit around and he regales us with old stories. Old milestones. Old weddings, old events from his calendars. in ninth grade. In ninth grade in 1980, I started keeping calendars my own. For me also, it's both a calendar and a diary. I've kept such calendars, diaries for the last 38 years. Mine are not as good as my dad's in some years. And when I was a kid, the calendars are about what you would expect from a kid. Some goofy parts, some embarrassing parts. But I did have the summer of 1982 documented pretty well. The event described by Dr. Ford presumably happened on a weekend because I believe everyone worked and had jobs in the summers. And in any event, a drunken early evening event of the kind she describes presumably happened on a weekend. If it was a weekend, my calendars show that I was out of town almost every weekend night before football training camp started in late August. The only weekend nights that I was in DC were Friday, June 4, when I was with my dad at a pro golf tournament. And had my high school achievement test at 8:30 the next morning. I also was in DC on Saturday night, August 7th, but I was at a small gathering at Becky's house in Rockville with Matt, Denise, Lori, and Jenny. Their names are all listed on my calendar. I won't use their last names here. And then on the weekend of August 20 to 22nd, I was staying at the Garretts with Pat and Chris as we did final preparations for football training camp that began on Sunday the 22nd. As the calendars confirm, that weekend before a brutal football training camp schedule was no time for parties. So let me emphasize this point. If the party described by Dr. Ford happened in the summer of 1982 on a weekend night, my calendar shows all but definitively that I was not there. During the weekdays in the summer of 1982, as you can see, I was out of town for 2 weeks of the summer for a trip to the beach with friends and at the legendary five-star basketball camp in Honesdale, Pennsylvania. When I was in town, I spent much of my time working out, lifting weights, playing basketball, or hanging out and having some beers with friends as we talked about life and football and school and girls. Some have noticed that I didn't have church on Sundays on my calendars. I also didn't list brushing my teeth. And for me, going to church on Sundays was like brushing my teeth. Automatic. Still is. In the summer of 1981, I had worked construction. In the summer of 1982, my job was cutting lawns. I had my own business of sorts. You see some specifics about the lawn cutting listed on the August calendar page. When I had to time the last lawn cuttings of the summer of various lawns before football training camp. I played in a lot of summer league basketball games for the Georgetown prep team at night at Blair High School in Silver Spring. Many nights I worked out with other guys at Tobin's house. He was the great quarterback on our football team, and his dad ran workouts or lifted weights at Georgetown Prep in preparation for the football season. I attended and watched many sporting events, as is my habit to this day. The calendars show a few weekday gatherings at friends' houses after a workout or just to meet up and have some beers. but none of those gatherings included the group of people that Dr. Ford has identified. And as my calendars show, I was very precise about listing who was there. Very precise. And keep in mind, my calendars also were diaries of sorts, forward-looking and backward-looking, just like my dad's. You can see, for example, that I crossed out missed workouts and the canceled doctor's appointments, and that I listed the precise people who had shown up for certain events. The calendars are obviously not dispositive on their own, but they are another piece of evidence in the mix for you to consider. Fifth, Dr. Ford's allegation is radically inconsistent with my record and my character from my youth to the present day. As students at an all-boys Catholic Jesuit school, many of us became friends and remain friends to this day with students at local Catholic all-girls schools. One feature of my life that has remained true to the present day is that I've always had a lot of close female friends. I'm not talking about girlfriends. I'm talking about friends who are women. That started in high school. Maybe it was because I'm an only child and had no sisters. But anyway, we had no social media or text or email, and we talked on the phone. I remember talking almost every night, it seemed, to my friends Amy or Julie. Or Kristen, or Karen, or Suzanne, or Maura, or Megan, or Nikki. The list goes on. Friends for a lifetime, built on a foundation of talking through school and life, starting at age 14. Several of those great women are in the seats right behind me today. My friends and I sometimes got together and had parties on weekends. The drinking age was 18 in Maryland for most of my time in high school and was 18 in DC for all of my time in high school. I drank beer with my friends. Almost everyone did. Sometimes I had too many beers. Sometimes others did. I liked beer. I still like beer. But I did not drink beer to the point of blacking out, and I never sexually assaulted anyone. There is a bright line between drinking beer, which I gladly do and which I fully embrace, and sexually assaulting someone, which is a violent crime. If every American who drinks beer or every American who drank beer in high school is suddenly presumed guilty of sexual assault, we'll be in an ugly new place in this country. I never committed sexual assault. As high school students, we sometimes did goofy or stupid things. I doubt we are alone in looking back at high school and cringing at some things. For one thing, our yearbook was a disaster. I think some editors and students wanted the yearbook to be some combination of Animal House, Caddyshack, and Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which were all recent movies at that time. Many of us went along in the yearbook to the point of absurdity. When we read about it and talked to each other. One thing in particular we're sad about. One of our good female friends who we would admire and went to dances with had her name used on the yearbook page with the term alumnus. That yearbook reference was clumsily intended to show affection and that she was one of us. But in this circus, the media has interpreted the term as related to sex. It was not related to sex. As the woman herself noted to the media on the record, she and I never had any sexual interaction at all. I'm so sorry to her for that yearbook reference. This may sound a bit trivial, given all that we are here for, but one thing I want to try to make sure of in the future is my friendship with her. She was and is a great person. As to sex, this is not a topic I ever imagined would come up at a judicial confirmation hearing, but I want to give you a full picture of who I was. I never had sexual intercourse or anything close to it during high school or for many years after that. In some crowds, I was probably a little outwardly shy about my inexperience. Tried to hide that. At the same time, I was also inwardly proud of it. For me and the girls who I was friends with, that lack of major or rampant sexual activity in high school was a matter of faith and respect and caution. The committee has a letter from 65 women who knew me in high school. They said that I always treated them with dignity and respect. That letter came together in one night, 35 years after graduation, while a sexual assault allegation was pending against me in a very fraught and public situation where they knew they'd be vilified if they defended me. Think about that. They put themselves on the line for me. Those are some awesome women, and I love all of them. You also have a letter from women who knew me in college. Most were varsity athletes. And they described that I treated them as friends and equals and supported them in their sports at a time when women's sports was emerging in the wake of Title IX. I thank all of them for all of their texts and their emails and their support. One of those women friends from college, a self-described liberal and feminist, sent me a text last night that said, quote, deep breaths. You're a good man, a good man, a good man. A text yesterday from another of those women friends from college said, quote, Brett, be strong, pulling for you to my core. A third text yesterday from yet another of those women I'm friends with from college said, I'm holding you in the light of God. As I said in my opening statement the last time I was with you, cherish your friends, look out for your friends, lift up your friends, love your friends. I felt that love more over the last 2 weeks than I ever have in my life. I thank all my friends. I love all my friends. Throughout my life, I've devoted huge efforts to encouraging and promoting the careers of women. I will put my record up against anyone's, male or female. I am proud of the letter from 84 women who worked with me at the Bush White House from 2001 to 2006 and described me as, quote, a man of the highest integrity. Read the op-ed from Sarah Day from Yarmouth, Maine. She worked in Oval Office operations outside of President Bush's office. Here's what she recently wrote in centralmaine.com. And today she stands by her comments. Quote, Brett was an advocate for young women like me. He encouraged me to take on more responsibility and to feel confident in my role. In fact, during the 2004 Republican National Convention, Brett gave me the opportunity to help with the preparation and review of the president's remarks, something I never would have had the chance to do if he had not included me. And he didn't just include me in the work. He made sure I was at Madison Square Garden to watch the president's speech instead of back at the hotel watching on TV. End quote. As a judge since 2006, I've had the privilege of hiring four recent law school graduates to serve as my law clerks each year. The law clerks for federal judges are the best and brightest graduates of American law schools. They work for one-year terms for judges after law school, and then they move on in their careers. For judges, training these young lawyers is an important responsibility. The clerks will become the next generation of American lawyers and leaders, judges and senators. Just after I took the bench in 2006, there was a major New York Times story about the low numbers of women law clerks at the Supreme Court and federal appeals courts. I took notice and I took action. A majority of my 48 law clerks over the last 12 years have been women. In a letter to this committee, my women law clerks said I was one of the strongest advocates in the federal judiciary for women lawyers. And they wrote that the legal profession is fairer and more equal because of me. In my time on the bench, no federal judge, not a single one in the country, has sent more women law clerks to clerk on the Supreme Court than I have. Before this allegation arose 2 weeks ago, I was required to start making certain administrative preparations for my possible transfer to the Supreme Court, just in case I was confirmed. As part of that, I had to, in essence, contingently hire a first group of four law clerks who could be available to clerk at the Supreme Court for me on a moment's notice. I did so and contingently hired four law clerks. All four are women. If confirmed, I'll be the first justice in the history of the Supreme Court to have a group of all women law clerks. That is who I am. That is who I was. Over the past 12 years, I've taught constitutional law to hundreds of students, primarily at Harvard Law School, while I was hired by then Dean and now Justice Elena Kagan. One of my former women students, a Democrat, testified to this committee that I was an even-handed professor who treats people fairly and with respect. In a letter to this committee, my former students, male and female alike, wrote that I displayed a character that impressed us all. I love teaching law, but thanks to what some of you on this side of the committee have unleashed, I may never be able to teach again. For the past 7 years, I've coached my two daughters' basketball teams. You saw many of those girls when they came to my hearing for a couple of hours. You have a letter from the parents of the girls I coached that described my dedication, commitment, and character. I coach because I know that a girl's confidence on the basketball court translates into confidence in other aspects of life. I love coaching more than anything I've ever done in my whole life. But thanks to what some of you on this side of the committee have unleashed, I may never be able to coach again. I've been a judge for 12 years. I have a long record of service to America and to the Constitution. I revere the Constitution. I am deeply grateful to President Trump for nominating me. He was so gracious to my family and me on the July night he announced my nomination at the White House. I thank him for his steadfast support. When I accepted the president's nomination, Ashley and I knew this process would be challenging. We never expected that it would devolve into this. Explaining this to our daughters has been about the worst experience of our lives. Ashley has been a rock. I thank God every day for Ashley and my family. We live in a country devoted to due process and the rule of law. That means taking allegations seriously. But if the mere allegation, the mere assertion of an allegation, a refuted allegation from 36 years ago, is enough to destroy a person's life and career, we will have abandoned the basic principles of fairness and due process that define our legal system and our country. I ask you to judge me by the standard that you would want applied to your father, your husband, your brother, or your son. My family and I intend no ill will toward Dr. Ford or her family. But I swear today, under oath, before the Senate and the nation, before my family and God, I am innocent of this charge.
Thank you, Judge Kavanaugh. Before we start questions, I won't repeat what I said this morning, but we'll do it the same way as we did for Dr. Ford, and 5-minute rounds. And so we will start with Ms. Mitchell.
Good afternoon, Judge Kavanaugh. We have not met. My name is Rachel Mitchell. I'd like to go over a couple of guidelines for our question and answer session today. If I ask a question...
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay.
All right, so Brett and I clearly have strong opinions and some analysis to share with you regarding Kavanaugh's opening statement. I don't want to do that now, considering the fact that the questioning has already begun.
Well, right now she's outlining the same way she outlined to the previous Christine Blasey Ford about it, saying if you have any problems.
So let's just quickly do as much as we can while we wait for the other line of questioning that will come from both Democrats and I'm guessing Rachel Mitchell on the Republican side. Okay, so that was an incredibly long opening statement from Brett Kavanaugh, and it began with the strategy of anger, and then later he was crying, he was sobbing, lots of water drinking, and there were some lies, or at least some inconsistencies in his opening statement that I do want to touch on. So, first, he did touch on the yearbook that was called into question. There were references to Renate alumnus in the yearbook, and his personal page also included that. There has been evidence to show that the reference to Renate was meant to brag about so-called sexual conquests. And he made it seem as though, no, this was all an attempt to show our admiration and affection for her. I mean, who believes that? Really? Do you really believe that?
He wants you to.
He wants you to.
So he, one thing that he keeps coming back to in his statements is that his mom was a judge and she always put everything through the same test. The same way you hear Cory Booker talk about his family buying a house all the time. You hear Brett Kavanaugh talk about how his mom said, what rings true? And to me, what rings true is probably based on what you thought going in. But in this, it just, nothing he says internally rings true. The thing that rings true to me is I heard her give her speech. What she said seemed like the truth for him. I think that he has every incentive personally to, if this is the narrative, continue refuting and denying until his dying day.
Right. And he is refusing to withdraw the nomination. He was angry, indignant. And look, to be fair, if you are dealing with what you perceive to be false allegations, you would be angry too. So I don't want to, you know, be unfair in that regard and be too judgmental about the tone. However, it didn't come off as a good strategy because, you know, what I'm seeing and also what I perceived myself was that it was too much. Like it went too far and it didn't come across as credible, especially when you compare his opening statement to the statement that we heard from Dr. Blasey Ford.
He needed to drink a lot of water and just look through moments in history that turn into viral moments. And people drinking water, it doesn't stay consistent with those who are telling the truth, if that's the small things that we're going to pull from it.
Right.
But also, he had a hold me back moment where he said, listen, I said it'd be fine with an FBI investigation. He cites a bunch of other FBI investigations that he went through in the past before this. Mm. But what rings true to me is everything everyone has said about how if she was victimized at a young age, she didn't share it with anyone until this moment. And now that this moment has brought this to the fore, why would he not insist? Instead, he says, hold me back. And he kind of dumps it on the Republicans.
There was quite a bit of regurgitation in his opening statement. Emphasizing the same talking points that we've heard. The talking point about how, you know, he also wants to appear sensitive to the sexual assault allegations while simultaneously denying that he was the one who did anything wrong. He says that he believes that she's been victimized, but says that it wasn't him. It might have been someone else. It's so ridiculous to say that. And Dr. Blasey Ford has already addressed that. She addressed it in the line of questioning that she had to deal with from Mitchell, the prosecutor that the Republicans hired. And so that talking point does nothing for me. But more importantly, he really wanted to emphasize how kind he's been to women throughout his life. And that might be true. But it is very possible to be kind to some women while also victimizing other women. It means nothing. Saying that you've employed women in your career means nothing. That does not debunk any type of sexual assault allegations. That doesn't prove anything. He also spent a lot of time talking about the calendar, and that serves as his alibi. And he also mentioned specifically that the calendar doesn't necessarily prove anything, but it is a piece of evidence that should be considered. The same can be said of the polygraph test, which Republicans were trying to brush under the rug, refused to show the results of during Dr. Blasey Ford's portion of the testimony. And look, I understand that polygraph tests are not 100% accurate. I think that that is an important point to bring up. However, it is also a piece of evidence that should be considered. It is not the end all be all, but it is a piece of the evidence that should be considered. And by the way, if Kavanaugh wanted an FBI investigation, then why wasn't there an FBI investigation? There wasn't. Republicans have been rushing this through. They refused the FBI investigation. They refused involving Mark Judge, who was allegedly the other person in the room as this alleged sexual assault took place. There were a lot of inconsistencies. You have to forget about his tone, okay? Forget about the speculative part. I know, sorry. Forget about the speculative part of all of this. Focus on what he's saying. And there are inconsistencies there. And I think that that should be the heart of what people focus on.
And let's go back to the
destroyed.
And
whoever wants, you know, whatever the committee decides, you know, I'm all in immediately. I'm all in immediately.
And the terrible and hard part of this is when we get an allegation, we're not in a position to prove it or disprove it. Therefore, we have to depend on some outside authority for it. And it just seemed to me then when these allegations came forward that you would want the FBI to investigate those claims and clear it up once and for all.
Senator, the committee investigates. It's not for me to say how to do it, but just so you know, the FBI doesn't reach a conclusion. They would give you a couple 302s that just tell you what we said. So I'm here. I wanted to be here the next day. It's an outrage that I was not allowed to come and immediately defend my name and say, I didn't do this and give you all this evidence. I'm not even in D.C. on the weekends in the summer of 1982. This happened on a weekday? Well, when I'm not at a Blair High School for a summer league game? I'm not at Tobin's house working out? I'm not at a movie with Suzanne? You know, I wanted to be here right away.
Well, the difficult thing is that these hearings are set and set by the majority. But I'm talking about getting the evidence and having the evidence looked at. And I don't understand, you know, we hear from the witnesses, but the FBI isn't interviewing them and isn't giving us any facts. So all we have—
You're interviewing me. You're doing it, Senator. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you're doing it. That's there's no conclusions reached.
And what you're saying, if I understand it, is that the allegations by Dr. Ford, Ms. Ramirez, and Ms. Svetnick are wrong.
Yeah, that is emphatically what I'm saying. Emphatically. The Svetnick thing is a joke. That is a farce.
Would you like to say more about it?
No.
Okay. That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Mitchell.
Dr. Ford has described you as being intoxicated at a party. Did you consume alcohol during your high school years?
Yes, we drank beer. My friends and I, the boys and girls, yes, we drank beer. I liked beer, still like beer. We drank beer. The drinking age, as I noted, was 18, so the seniors were legal. Senior year in high school, people were legal to drink. And we drank beer. And I said sometimes probably had too many beers, and sometimes other people had too many beers. Drank beer. We liked beer.
What do you consider to be too many beers?
I don't know. Whatever the chart says. On your blood alcohol chart.
When you talked to Fox News the other night, you said that there were times in high school when people might have had too many beers on occasion. Does that include you?
Sure. Okay.
Have you ever passed out from drinking?
Passed out would be no, but I've gone to sleep, but I've never blacked out. That's the allegation. That's wrong.
So let's talk about your time in high school. In high school, after drinking, did you ever wake up in a different location than you remembered passing out or going to sleep?
No.
Did you ever wake up with your clothes in a different condition or fewer clothes on than you remembered when you went to sleep or passed out?
No. Yeah, no.
Did you ever tell, did anyone ever tell you about something that happened in your presence that you didn't remember and during a time that you had been drinking?
No. We drank beer and, you know, so did I think the vast majority of people our age at the time. But in any event, we drank beer and still do. So whatever... Yeah.
During the time in high school when you would be drinking, did anyone ever tell you about something that you did not remember?
No.
Dr. Ford described a small gathering of people at a suburban Maryland home in the summer of 1982. She said that Mark Judge, P.J. Smith, and Leland Ingham also were present, as well as an unknown male, and that the people were drinking to varying degrees. Were you ever at a gathering that fits that description?
No, as I've said in my opening statement.
Dr. Ford described an incident where she was alone in a room with you and Mark Judge. Have you ever been alone in a room with Dr. Ford and Mark Judge?
No.
Dr. Ford described an incident where you were grinding your genitals on her. Have you ever ground or rubbed your genitals against Dr. Ford?
No.
Dr. Ford described an incident where you covered her mouth with your hand. Have you ever covered Dr. Ford's mouth with your hand?
No.
Dr. Ford described an incident where you tried to remove her clothes. Have you ever tried to remove her clothes?
No.
Referring back to the definition of sexual behavior that I have given you, have you ever at any time engaged in sexual behavior with Dr. Ford?
No.
Have you ever engaged in sexual behavior with Dr. Ford, even if it was consensual?
No.
I want to talk about your calendars. You submitted to the committee copies of the handwritten calendars that you've talked about for the months of May, June, July, and August of 1982. You have them in front of you?
I do.
Did you create these calendars in the sense of all the handwriting that's on them?
Yes.
Okay. Is it exclusively your handwriting?
Yes.
When did you make these entries?
In 1982.
Has anything been changed for those since 1982?
No.
Do these calendars represent your plans for each day, or do they document, in other words, prospectively, right, or do they document what actually occurred more like a diary?
They're both forward-looking and backward-looking, as you can tell by looking at them, because I cross out certain doctor's appointments that didn't happen, or one night where I was supposed to lift weights, I crossed that out because I obviously didn't make it that night. So you can see
things so we've
that
rotated.
I didn't do.
And now Bretson.
I'm still here. You're new.
Yes, I'm new.
Specific people who and I was
he's,
with.
Yeah. You saw his, and right now he's saying.
Oh, I've been watching.
So what did you think of his opening statement?
I think women are too emotional sometimes.
So ridiculous.
That's what his defenders will, of course, say. He kind of lost it. I have complicated, multi-layered thoughts, but I think for now we probably have to tell this on.
Right now, this is they're trying to make it a he said, she said at the beginning of this line of questioning, and now they're asking, are these calendars accurate?
All of the specific things, yeah. Do you find the calendar thing compelling at all?
No.
Yeah, I don't.
No, listen, what rings true? I'm going to use his own test against him throughout the entirety of this. What rings true to me is, and now they're taking
a recess. Oh, he's leaving. He's leaving. I think he's pulling his nomination. Oh, no, it's break. Okay.
What rings true to me is that some kid at high school will not write down in his calendar, went to party, raped someone.
Or even went to small gathering.
No.
Why would you write that down? Yeah, I don't get the whole calendar thing. And even the defense. So look, if you were out on all the weekends and you could prove that, that's perfectly fine. But he doesn't even know exactly if it was a weekend or a weekday night. So he says that, and then he says, well, and then on the weekdays, you know, what about when I was working out at my friend's house? Okay, well, maybe that day they were going to have a gathering, and so instead of working out, you went to this party. That doesn't actually prove anything. It's interesting, I guess, but it doesn't prove anything.
Because in tight.
Now, I would say overall, look, I think some people's defense of him is simply, it is difficult to prove that you didn't do something. And I get that. Mm-hmm. It is obviously difficult. And that's why we need as much information as possible. But if you were going to assert, as he did many times, that there is this complicated conspiracy, that multiple people have come forward mm-hmm. and are being paid or whatever to do this, you also kind of have to provide some evidence for that, a reason why we would be more likely to believe that than what seems to be the case, which is a kid known for getting excessively drunk groped somebody.
Yes.
In this particular case, you know, setting aside all the other accusations.
And his, I mean, it is, makes, in my opinion, it makes him look more guilty when he says, I was at a Catholic, Jesuit, boys' high school.
Going to church was like going, like brushing my teeth.
Right, well, that's a separate thing. To me, everything I know about Catholic, all-boys, Jesuit high schools mm-hmm. is that some really weird stuff happens there. Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, I went to a place called Chaminade, which is a Marianist school. Yes, Marianists and Jesuits are arch rivals in the sectarian conflict of Catholic education. But Loyola High School, downtown LA, they did some crazy things. Mm-hmm. Their parties were crazy. And that's not just at those Jesuits, and not just at that school. Throughout history, it is known that that a all-boys Catholic high school does some really fucked up shit.
Well, and you can learn some of that, I think, from Mark Judge's book and the various things that he's written.
Yes.
Well, just to confirm, we're going to be told when he's coming back, right? Okay, good.
Okay,
I want to bring up a possibility to you that I saw Chris Hayes talking about. So there was a lot of attention given during Christine Blasey Ford's section about how it is that when in a moment of trauma you remember things. So what I think is an interesting, so we've been talking mainly about either he did it or he didn't do it. But there's a third possibility. I mean, it's technically under the he did it thing, but that he did it, she remembers it because it was a huge moment of trauma mm-hmm. for her. And he doesn't remember.
Because it was a Wednesday.
Because it was a Wednesday. Either that he didn't consider it sexual assault, and bear in mind, in those some of those movies, Animal House and stuff like that, I forget exactly, Revenge of the Nerds, there's just depictions of rape that are considered tricks or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. views of these things were very different then. What is considered sexual assault, even now, that act, many people are saying, is that really sexual assault? Imagine in 1982 what a young boy would have thought about it. Did he think he committed an attempted rape when he did it? Probably not. And then you add in the alcohol. I think it's entirely possible that he could be indignant and defending himself either because he knows what he did but doesn't think that it's attempted rape, or he doesn't remember at all, but he actually did it.
Also, for when I watched her testimony, she was listening to questions and answering them to the best of her ability in a very measured way. Yeah. He is all over the place. And not just, and so he also says that he wrote his opening statement by himself. It is his words,
Why would he do that?
Well, and he showed it to a clerk, which mm-hmm. was probably someone who looked a certain way. But he wrote it by himself, saying he doesn't need help from anyone else. And the reason he doesn't need help from anyone else is he is a high-ranking judge who has gone through much lawyer school. And he's using these weird lawyer tricks, like keep it consistent. Things that he's learned, and when he's frazzled, it seems like he repeats the same lines mm-hmm. that to me sound like things he's come up with that he thinks are clever, but they're too clever by half. He twice now has said, I had beer, we all had beer, I like beer now. Mm-hmm. That is something that to me sounds like the calculated response he has formulated for himself over the years.
Yeah,
it just doesn't.
It almost sounds like a line from an intervention from an overly defensive person.
It's just messaging. He's messaging now. She was answering questions, and he's messaging.
And I will also say, I think, I don't know, maybe this doesn't undercut it, but his statement that I wrote this yesterday, okay, which is weird because we saw his written opening statement yesterday morning. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, obviously he changed it since there were no references in what I read to him crying uncontrollably. But many of the lines that he's using were in his Fox interview the day before. Mm-hmm. So, okay, I guess you wrote it yourself, but you're certainly taking notes from your greatest hits through the course of these past 2 weeks.
There's still no reason not to have an FBI investigation.
Well, okay, let's turn to that, because Dianne Feinstein wasn't able to get in many questions because he kept interrupting her and talking over her. But one thing she asked twice was, if you believe that you're innocent, why have you not called for an FBI investigation? Which I think, at this point, is a pretty easy thing for him to do. And he kept saying, I wanted a hearing the day after, and refused to say that he wants an FBI investigation. He just wanted a hearing, but
right.
quicker.
You're interviewing me, he says. You're doing it now. It's mm-hmm. like, are you kidding me? You're a judge, dude. Would you rather have an independent law enforcement conducted investigation to draw from when hearing a case? Or would you rather have members of the Congress asking questions in a what you already have claimed is a biased witch hunt?
And a carefully controlled process, too. Okay, so I know that there was a little bit of talk about his opening statement, but I wasn't here for that. So I'm also curious, his opening statement overall or in parts, do you think that it helped him in the context of what we saw from Christine Blasey Ford?
Well, before he gave his opening statement, we hadn't heard anything from him. We had just heard compelling testimony from her. Mm-hmm. Now we've heard testimony from him that I am certain people who were like, oh gosh, she's pretty compelling, are more inclined to look for anything in his testimony. Folks that were on his side will look for anything in his testimony, and they'll find it in there. They find it in there.
Mm-hmm. So but do you think that it was effective?
It was, yeah. I think it was effective for his purposes. Mm-hmm. But when you look at it, like, what, if anything at all, really can affect this in the long run? Do you think anything that happens here, there needs to be a huge public outcry to slow down this investigation, and it is happening, and it may happen, or to slow down this hearing process for a vote that's supposed to happen like tomorrow.
Yeah.
But
or
he
possibly
did,
this weekend. There was some indication Trump might be calling for that.
He did what he had to do. I wonder if during this break people are like, bro, you need to slow down.
Get
you
it.
Need to take a drink, have a beer. I mean, what I would do is be like, this guy clearly seems like an alcoholic. He is like kind of twitching and he's way too aggressive. You're an accused rapist, attempted rapist, and by others, an accused rapist. You should not be too aggressive right now.
Well, we sort of predicted that he would come out and be super aggressive. I think in terms of evaluating the success of it, you have those two different parts. You have his aggressive, shouty defense of himself.